pastor friend once said to me that there are two main reasons why people come to church. They come because something is broken or something is missing. In his mind, some people come because something is broken. There might be a deep grief in their life that is very hard to get past. There may be deep regrets that they wish more than anything they could undo. And there may be other just very deep frustrations that have brought sadness for many years. So some people come because something is broken. Others come because something is missing. And on the surface, their life might be a textbook example of success with their education, their career, planning for their retirement, how they have adult children who have successfully launched into the world. On the surface, everything may look like a great success. But at a certain point in life, success isn't all that it seemed to promise. There's something still missing. And there's a sense that there are some things that are more important than success, like significance or making a tangible difference in the lives of others. And so some people come because something is missing, and they are searching for a more authentic community where they can be themselves and acknowledge their own spiritual needs and hunger. So people usually come either because something is broken or something is missing. And maybe that's why the crowd was there in Athens on this day that is described in the book of Acts. That even amidst this marketplace of many different gods and goddesses, multiple traditions represented there, surely many of the people even there were searching. Now, Paul begins his speech or sermon on Mars Hill by saying, I can see that you were very religious because of all of the idols. And it would be great to have heard Paul's tone of voice, because Acts has already told us that Paul is deeply distressed by all the idols. They told us that he's been spending time arguing with people in the synagogues and the marketplaces. And so it could be that Paul is being very sarcastic. Yeah, you have all these idols. I can see that you're very religious, but maybe that means something more like superstitious. I can see how superstitious you are. And that might be how Paul is beginning his sermon. But I don't think so. I think Paul is saying, I can see that you are very religious, because you're all searching for something. And I also wonder how Paul could have stood there, even though he was a very faithful Jew, and not be moved by the temples that he saw, just the sheer scale of them. And I've never been to Athens, but I have been to Egypt with a group from my seminary 30 years ago. And we went to Jordan, Israel, and Egypt. And it was such a thrill for me to see the great pyramids in person. I loved every minute of it. And then we also went to the south in Luxor. And for me personally, what was even more impressive than the pyramids themselves was that great temple at Karnak. The roof is now missing, but the pillars are intact. They draw your attention upward. The hieroglyphics are still remarkably preserved. And even though I'm very much a faithful Christian, I was moved by that temple. And even tourists today who may consider themselves atheists or agnostic, they may find themselves sitting in the great cathedrals in Europe and are moved to say a prayer or to light a candle. And there's something about our great works of art that seem to draw us to God, or to some sense or curiosity about the divine. There's a character in a J.M. Coetzee novel, and I don't remember which one, But the character said that he believed in God simply because of the music of Bach. That Bach's music couldn't have been merely or simply human. But there was something deeper that it pointed to. And so we have this religious impulse that encourages us to search. And so I don't think all the discussions that were happening at Athens were simply, you know, starting religious fights for the sake of religious fights. I remember a band trip one time from El Paso to Los Angeles, and it was in the middle of the night, and one of my classmates decided to announce to another friend who was Catholic that all Catholics were cannibals because they believed that Christ was literally present in the body and the bread. And I thought to myself, oh great, it's going to be a long night. And it was. I don't have a lot of patience for starting religious fights just for the sake of starting a religious fight. But when people are really searching, like don't make fun of someone because they can see God in a sunset, because that's a beginning place. It's a chance to talk about awe. Or don't make fun of someone because they find themselves being moved by the Eastern religions and they're thinking of themselves more as a Buddhist. And maybe you're tempted to think that this is very superficial and you want to give them a pop quiz about the noble truths to see if they can answer it. But I would say don't do that, because it's a beginning point. In our bulletin, we say that everyone is welcome wherever they are on their religious journey. And I believe that. And I think that this is a safe community for people who are searching. And so whatever religious impulse, whatever sense of awe or gratitude is always a good beginning point. And it's an opportunity for further discussion. Our denomination has a confirmation curriculum called Big God, Big Questions. And I love that because it emphasizes what the Reformed tradition has always taught, that God is sovereign and so much more than we can imagine or express in words. Anyone who is a true Calvinist is also a humble Calvinist. And if they're not humble, then they're not a true Calvinist. And I would say not even fully Christian in some ways, because God is always bigger than we can imagine. We don't have a possession of God. At best, we simply point. We point in the directions where we believe we've seen God or the Spirit at work. We talk about how the example of Jesus has moved us. But we don't possess it. We don't have exclusive possession. And then the second half of that title is Big Questions. That ideally, the Presbyterian Church at its best has always been a place where people can come and bring their honest questions. And that thing that you think that you're not supposed to say in Sunday school or church, maybe you should risk going ahead and saying it. Because as a community of faith, we ought to be able to handle that and to explore it together. Because this is part of our faith journey. This is how we join each other on our journeys. Now, near the end of Paul's speech, Paul talks about resurrection. And in the Greek language, that word resurrection is a feminine noun. And so the response after that was, he seems to be talking about new divinities. And so some in the Greek audience might have assumed that Paul was talking about Jesus and his spouse, Jesus and this female god named Resurrection. And then the way that Paul approaches this. Let me first say that there is a level of suspense in here. Because why was Socrates executed several centuries before? For proclaiming supposedly new divinities and corrupting the minds of the youth. And so for Paul to be accused of this, there's an element of danger. And so throughout this speech, Paul is defending himself, trying to make himself known and understood. And then Paul doesn't do this with abstractions so much. He does it by sharing the story of Jesus and how God is seen in the story of Jesus. And then finally, in sharing how Jesus was raised from the dead. And according to the text, this caused some of them to scoff, or some of them to say, we'd like to hear more from you about this. But Paul doesn't try to prove it or to hit them over the head with it. I'm reminded of a story years ago of a woman who called into a religious radio program. And she was saying that she was having some honest doubts. And then the host of the program was saying, now, Barbara, you shouldn't be doubting. I have this book that I have written, which offers irrefutable proof that Jesus was raised from the dead and is who he says he is. And then Barbara said, I don't think you're hearing me. I'm saying that I personally am having trouble believing right now. And then the radio host just repeated himself. Now, Barbara, let me tell you, I'm going to send you this book. I'm going to send you this book that I have written, and it will prove to you beyond any doubt that Jesus was raised from the dead, and he is who he says he is. Now, Barbara, if I send you this book, will you believe? And then finally, she just said yes. And it may come to a surprise to you, but like I'm disappointed that Barbara gave up so easily. Because there isn't any kind of like solid scientific or historic proof. And even if there were, we would still have to accept it as an article of faith that Jesus' resurrection also means that we have new life. But Paul did what Christians have always have done. They told the story. And it reminds me of this scene that I think I've shared before that happened in a small Lutheran church in the Bronx on Palm Sunday. They decided to reenact the events of Palm Sunday. They marched through the streets. There were some protesters in the streets who accidentally became a part of the church procession, and then everyone ended up back in the church for a reenactment of the events of Holy Week. And when it came time for the resurrection scene, there were three volunteers who had volunteered to share their testimony. And each one of them began it by saying, I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. And the first was a woman named Angie, who shared very honestly and poignantly about her life on the streets, about her drug addictions, and how she finally just one day walked into the doors of this church and became clean, had help with her addictions, became part of 12-step groups, decided to become a Jesus follower, and how she was now leading Bible studies and even thinking about going to seminary. And the thrust of her testimony was simply, I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. And the next person who shared was a businessman named Kevin, who is a high-powered lawyer in Manhattan. And he was one of those people that I kind of alluded to earlier whose life seemed like a textbook success in every sense of the word, yet there was something that was still missing. And somehow he heard someone talking about this quirky little Lutheran church in the South Bronx, and his curiosity was aroused. And so he also started going and became a very active member of that church. And the thrust of his testimony was, I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. And then finally, the third volunteer also talked about how about growing up in the church, but how nonetheless, the way that people had cared for each other, the way that people were motivated to serve others, all of this for him indicated that Jesus was alive. I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. Now, the script only called for three people to testify, and then the Holy Week play would come to an end. But after the third person gave the testimony, someone else stood up and said, I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. And then after that, yet another person stood up and said, I know that Jesus lives because he lives in me. And the testimony continued like that. And that's how all the great sermons end. Whether it's Paul preaching on Mars Hill, it ends with people sharing very simply, I know that Jesus lives because Jesus lives in me. All glory and praise be to our God. Amen.